This is Icon Art Radio. Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. And here we are. I might mention that if you get an Icon newsletter, if you just happen to be a member of Icon, which is something I highly recommend to keep Icon going, you got our newsletter. The schedule was a little screwed up in there about the Icon Art Radio this month, so we're like a week off. So if you're confused, you may have missed something. You can go to our icon-art.org, and if you feel like you missed a show, it'll be up there, and you can download it and listen on our website. So we had a very interesting and fun and successful Odd Thursday about children's illustration, and I thought it might be fun to talk a little bit more about that. What did you bring in to continue the dialogue, Donna?
Well, I brought in a quote by Picasso that's relevant, but I'll bring that in a little bit later, because I think, first of all, it would be nice to just tell our listeners what happened at that Odd Thursday, because we had many examples, many slides of children's book illustration, all the way from William Blake in 1789 and his book Songs of Innocence, all the way through the great classic illustrators, John Tenniel, who did Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, illustrators like Howard Pyle, Anne C. Wyeth, Arthur Rackham, Beatrix Potter, and so forth, and then all the way through to the wonderful contemporary illustrators, with a little interlude of the 1950s, where we all were just completely taken back to our childhood with pictures from little golden books. Mm-hmm. Most of those illustrators weren't overly famous. We recognize their style more than their names, but what happened in the room was that the spirit of childhood was invoked in pretty much everybody in the room, and you could really feel that joy and innocence and lack of the tendency to critique anything, you know, but to just enjoy it. And we had several tables of actual children's books for people to look at afterwards, and I think more people stayed after the meeting was over last week mm-hmm. than just about any other time, because everybody wanted to look at these children's books.
They were pouring over the books.
Find their favorites. So I'd like to start out just talking about that. Like, what is it about the spirit of children's book illustration that does that to a room full of adults?
I think it has to do with discovery. Mm. When you're a kid and you get one of these illustrated books, because of the sort of unusual genre of children's books, where the illustrators typically are not all that well known, unless it's, you know, Theo Gazelle or somebody like that, it means that you've never seen that kind of illustration before. Plus, you don't know what the story is, and so it's a shortcut into the text. Plus, every couple of pages, you know, there's another visual discovery. Plus, the whole experience is usually accompanied by a certain amount of doting adult. So it's a pretty rich exploratory thing. It's like you and the adult are diving into an unknown realm and then finding all this new stuff. And I think what we remember, the joy of it, at the time, I don't remember thinking of it as a joyful experience. I remember it as more just completely involving and you know, exciting. And I think that what was engaging me was you know, seeing new things while accompanied by someone who, you know, would just make it more important and safer and, you know, in some way more interesting.
That's cool. I really like that mm-hmm. way of looking at it, you know, mm-hmm. because it's like you have the people that you're most comfortable with in the world at that point, your mom or your dad, mm-hmm. being the captain of the ship, in a sense, you know, taking you on this journey through yeah. whatever it is. So I didn't really think of that aspect.
The experience that goes along with reading children's books is one of the most comfy and comforted moments in our early childhood. And I think we carry that through. So it wakes up those memories.
Well, it's the epitome of mother is at home.
Yeah.
You know, you're safe and everything is right with the world. And now we're going to do something that breaks boundaries, but just a few of them and only gently.
Mm-hmm. And then when the children, because I remember having piles of my favorite children's books that my mom had read to me sitting on the floor even before I could actually read, and then I would sit there during the day and just pore over these books again and again, the same books. And probably, I mean, just looking back on it, even when I was looking at them by myself, it probably carried that sense of mother is at home while I was looking at those pictures. And also the aspect of discovery, the first time you read a children's book and you're introduced to some new story and new world, it's this wonderful aha, but then we always like to go back and to then it becomes familiar territory, and we go back again and back again and back again, and then we are going to visit our friends. So you have both the discovery and then you have the familiarity and all of these strange characters in Dr. Seuss or whatever, or the little children in the books that are just like you know, that look just like us in the 50s and play the same games that we played in the 50s, and their parents are like our parents, and we have this broadening circle of friends through these characters in the books.
I remember how important, in a few of the books, how important the illustrations were. Yeah. When I had gotten into actually reading them myself, but I still hoped that a book would have pictures in it. And reading all the rest of the Mary Poppins books. And there was something, it was like the illustrations were sort of a guide to how to build the interior world that you build when you're reading to yourself. So you have it read to you and you look over your mother's shoulder at the pictures, and then later you read it yourself, but the pictures sort of confirm that you're on the right track. Mm-hmm. And I think they might have an important role to play in the process of learning to read. I don't know.
Well, I think the artists themselves and the pictures are tuning. There's a certain quality to children's book illustrations. They're tuning into something. And because it's children's book illustrations, not the serious art world, they have much more of a green light to go to that place. And this is the same place that we've talked about in over 100 shows here on Icon Radio, of that goal and the source that we're going back to and bringing up to the surface in fine art. I think that the children's book illustrators, in many ways, get at that innocent place. And are given more of a green light to do that than in the serious art world, where there's more competition and winning the game and all this involved. Because we were talking about, there's this flavor in those things that is so rich in mythic reality. Mm. And that's sort of what children's books are all about. And also, I might say that the stories themselves, apart from the pictures, are pretty much classic formulas with a resolution at the end. And that I think we're hardwired to need that. And that's why the kid wants to hear the story over and over again, how the princess is saved and all this stuff. And that's why myth is often told in stories, and we're taught the patterns of consciousness through these stories, because there's particular patterns of consciousness that repeat over and over, and the whole of our reality that we live in is made up of these pattern structures. Yeah. So when we recognize the archetypes, there's something, an aha about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, kids want you to read that. They want to go through that again and again and again. They want over and over again. Mm-hmm. Even apart from like just being with the mother again who's reading it, I think that they want to experience that story again and go through that. I mean, I'm that way too with movies sure. that I like and stories that I like, and the Ramayana and the Mahabharata and all those elements. There's just this like touching into those archetypal patterns.
Well, and it's because parents are the ones who actually buy the children's books. I think it has to be that universal because the parents are buying them and the parents are going to be reading them to the children until the kids are old enough to read them on their own. And you find that for the most part, parents don't get tired of reading the books to the children. You know, there's a few really silly, badly written books that I remember there was one that my kids were attached to that was just a stupid book, basically. And they wanted, and it got to be sort of a joke because they knew I really didn't want to read that book again. And they knew it was ridiculous and they themselves were tired of it, but it was kind of like, let's read that book, you know. And we would,
well, did they really, until it got to that point, did they really like to hear that over and over again?
Not really. Well, they sort of liked it. I mean, it was kind of a cute story. It was called The Elf Book, and it was just one of those really little cheap books, you know, from the grocery store or something. And I think it was a counting book or an alphabet book or something like that. But it was very silly and mundane, sort of, I thought. But what happened when they would make these jokes about, you know, let's read The Elf Book again, to make it interesting, I would then change it as I read it to them or do voices.
There was something about the pattern and interaction that you guys did together around this.
It got to be a creative thing. Yeah. But I wanted to go back and read this. This is a good spot to insert this Picasso quote, because what you were saying, Bill, about the mythic themes and all that, one of the things I noticed in watching the slides of especially the old classic illustrators is that most of the faces that they drew were not what we would consider beautiful. The ones that were the most interesting illustrations by Arthur Rackham, John Tenniel, even Alice's face was not a pretty face in that. And you know, and then you have like the Queen and King of Hearts and the other characters, and they were kind of grotesque, but you like looking at them. And same with Arthur Rackham. So anyway, I found this little story that Picasso told one time, and I thought it fit nicely into this. He says, "Have you ever seen anything more beautiful than that old woman? I am sure that she has never washed. There you have..." Excuse me, I have to take off my glasses here. No, sorry. "There you have an..." Okay, I'm going to start over again. "Have you ever seen anything more beautiful than that old woman? I am sure that she has never washed. There you have an honest-to-goodness old woman. She provides her..." Do you want to read this?
No,
I can't see it really well. This printing is
right. I'll read it.
"She powders herself with dust. She looks like a mushroom that has grown out of the spot. How Velasquez would have loved to..." Can you read it, Alan? I'm sorry.
And now we have the passage.
Do you need
of the book.
We have extra reading glasses down there, if that'll help.
Okay.
We didn't bring the right ones.
"Have you ever seen anything more beautiful than that old woman? I'm sure that she has never washed. There you have an honest-to-goodness old woman. She powders herself with dust. Sembla un bolé d'aque terre. Pardon. She looks like a mushroom that has grown out of the spot. How Velasquez would have loved to meet her. One should paint her exactly as she is. Underneath, she is just like everybody else, but she belongs to the school on filth. See how she laughs because we're looking her over. Good evening. How do you do? Getting along? Good, good, very good. We'll see you tomorrow. Yes, indeed, until tomorrow."
So what I liked about that quote is his innocent tuning in to the beauty of this old woman sitting by the side of the road that most people would go by and turn away from and not consider beautiful. And those are the kind of characters in the old children's books that we love the most. The strange little grotesque ones. And children have not, I think it's probably, I was trying to remember, like, what age you get a kind of social concept of beauty imposed upon you. And you certainly do, to a large degree, in adolescence, but it starts a little bit before that, I think. And gradually you begin to see, oh, that's beautiful, and that's not.
Yeah, you start to have preferences, or conscious preferences, too. Because I remember I didn't care about that sort of thing originally. There were things that appealed and didn't appeal, but I didn't think about them. I didn't put them in categories. It's interesting, too, that, you know, there's a couple of dimensions to this. One is the ritual aspect of it, that we want to go through that experience of discovering that the monster isn't going to get the girl or whatever it is. And I remember my mother talking about how my sister would beg for her to read this story called Little Sally Mandy Lost in the Deep Dark Woods. And my sister would sit there in rapt attention and burst into tears every time little Sally Mandy got lost. And she would just be devastated. And then Sally Mandy would be rescued at the end. And every single time she heard the story, she had the same reaction. It was completely overshadowing. And this went on, I believe, for years. So she probably heard the story hundreds of times.
Wow.
And it says something about, you know, the formative quality of childhood experience, and how, you know, we're probably hardwired to find the paradigm and burn it into our system so that, you know, we know how things are supposed to go. And I would guess that fiction or stories in general, whether they're true or not, must play a tremendously important role in establishing those patterns for expectation of how things are supposed to go and how you're supposed to react to them. And then the other aspect of it that was coming to mind was this series of extraordinarily horrifying little stories for children. They were didactic stories. They were not written to entertain children. They were written to terrify them.
Yeah.
And they were written to spook them and put the fear of, you know, eternal damnation into
them. The morality stories.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
A friend of mine sent me some illustrations, which I had seen a long time ago, from a series of German books.
I saw those,
about these little boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're little morality tales. And the little boy eats more than he's supposed to at dinner. And one thing leads to another, and the entire family, you know, is destroyed by the gluttony of this nasty little boy, who then, you know, spends his last few days in, you know, horror and agony. And the drawings of the people are grotesque and frightening and, you know, nightmarish. And that's where the adults are trying to use these mechanisms to take advantage of children and what I guess they perceive as, you know, appropriate ways. But,
well, that's one side of that same coin, and the other side of the coin are the kind of wrinkly old people with the big noses and stuff like that, but that are very endearing characters,
right,
in these books. That they're not beautiful people, but they're, many times in these stories, they're the good guy or the good,
right,
woman, you know, that saves the day. And so it's an interesting thing. There was one of the slides that we had the other night was an N.C. Wyeth painting of a giant walking along the beach and children on the beach. Mm. And it is an absolutely gorgeous painting. You know, you actually want to hug the giant, even though he's just, you know, a big giant walking. But the interesting thing to me about how that painting was made for the illustration is that the children were painted in stark detail, you know, and shadow and light and all that, and the giant was in these like beautiful soft colors and almost angelic sort of style that it was mm-hmm. that the giant was painted. I don't know what story that went with.
He was sort of emerging out of the sky.
Yeah, like out of the mist or something like that. And I guess that's another point about those children's books back then in the 19th century is there was a huge emphasis on the invisible world, invisible mm-hmm. beings of giants, angels, fairies, elves, all of that whole realm, brownies and gnomes and everything. A great number of those artists even specialized in fairies and and elves and all. And then it faded away. In the 50s, the books are very more like realistic stories about contemporary children. And then in the 60s, there was kind of a resurgence for us old hippies.
It went away with early modern life, the first half of the 20th century. But it has come back, and it's big now.
Yeah, is it big again? It's big in the 60s.
There's all these books about fairies, and the kids love the fairies. And there's definitely, after the 60s, there was much more interest again in the inner worlds and the inner life.
Right, yeah.
Which opened up all these possibilities again for children's literature.
Yeah. Well, look at, you know, Maxfield Parrish reprint books, you know, in the 60s. They were among the most popular books on the shelf.
Mm-hmm. But there was a revival because before that, I didn't even know anything about the illustrators until about the 70s when... because of the sort of loosening up in that area that came out of the 60s, there was suddenly a revival in the popular market, like in the independent bookstores and stuff, of cards of all these illustrators of the 19th century.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And then it all of a sudden disappeared about 1980. Mm. We had this opening up, and then in 1980... suddenly, all the stuff in the bookstores, the cards and the calendars and stuff, was completely different. It was much more changed. It was more photographs of beach boys with muscles and Venice Beach and all that. I remember suddenly it was different.
Well, that's interesting.
And now there's a. I think it's going back again. I think we're getting that fairy tale mm-hmm. stuff a little bit has crept back into that market. prior to 1970, what you saw in the bookstores actually were reproductions of art, Monets and Cezannes. Mm. The great artists had of early modernism and of impressionism. Had become kind of what cards and calendars and stuff were all about, besides pin-up girls, which you saw in men's mechanic shops and stuff. But otherwise, I remember it was sort of jarring. It was like we were going in a way because I was always liking all these art cards that you saw. It was funny to have it go back to the sweetness and innocence of children's book illustrations again.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I never really thought about what makes card manufacturers, how do they decide which images to put out on the shelves at any particular time, but there must be some kind of cultural response, you know, that the people at that particular time respond to certain particular images and types of images.
Sure.
That would be a fascinating thing to research.
Yeah, plot the popularity of different kinds of images.
Yeah, plotting the popular visual arts market is actually quite interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine there are people vigorously pursuing that for commercial reasons.
And they've got their finger on the pulse of what's happening in culture. And it was actually independent publishers that picked up on this, such as Green Tiger Press and Pomegranate mm-hmm. and Portal Publications mm-hmm. in California. It was Green Tiger that was actually the first to show the children's book illustrators as in a format that would go in bookstores as cards and calendars and mm-hmm. stuff. And very quickly in California, it was suddenly they were everywhere. Arthur Rackham, who I'd never heard of, was all over the place and with his illustrations. What got it was the Darlings that ran Green Tiger Press that I think started the whole thing. They were kind of the older couple, hippie couple in La Jolla that ran the independent bookstore and the independent art theater. And they also were collectors of first edition children's books. Mm. And so they had a huge collection of like that, Delac and Rackham and Ty Nielsen and those different people. And they realized that they could take these images and just reproduce them and sell them as cards and calendars because they were outside of, they were now in the public domain. They were, the copyright had run out on them. So they just started doing it. And then you could see that the others, other people saw the way it was going and picked up on it. Mm-hmm. And these other publishing companies emerged.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Perfect timing, because I remember I wasn't even in California. I lived on the East Coast at the time, but I was very into Green Tiger Press and the bookstores. There were
well,
loaded
they,
with
they
all
would
of their
sell through
things,
networks.
Too.
So they didn't sell through big distribution.
Yeah,
they only dealt with independent bookstores, which were still thriving at that point.
Right. Yeah.
And that's because so their stuff was all over the country.
Mm-hmm. And that was my framed art back in. Yeah. You know, I was an art collector back then of those little cards, and you know, sometimes you'd get them in 5x7 instead of smaller size, and then you could frame them and put them on your wall.
So that's what you know, what Lynn and I were doing together. That's another radio show, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe we should think about that.
Yeah, that's a good idea for maybe our next show.
Or it would be nice to have Lynn here, but who is coming? So we can think about that.
Oh, that would be good, yeah.
Excellent. Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.